industrialization and social defense. What has been well and truly buried from view this last two centuries and more are the uses of the market for the pursuit of social ends. However, the social dimensions of economics was acknowledged at the very dawn of economics as a discipline. The first chair of economics in Europe was established at the University of Naples in 1776 under the title Chair of Civil Economy. Antonio Genovese, who first held the chair, was a pioneer in the study of social economy and had a direct influence on his contemporary, Adam Smith. It is only now that the hidden history of social economy is coming to light. The exclusion of society from the development of economic theory has had profound, lasting, and deeply damaging effects. Society's survival response to the plain idiocy of the autonomous market doctrine asserted itself from the first attempts to enforce market logic on human systems. The struggle continues to this day. The great experiments in socialism and cooperativism, the emergence of trade unions, and the battle for democratic rights in the economy as well as in politics were all part of this human response to an inhuman system. They appeared as soon as the first hammer blows of the machine age were felt. And while the forms of this struggle first evolved in our own industrial societies, the models of resistance and reform that are now unfolding in developing countries mirror the social and collectivist models that arose in the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. As Pogliani put it, the overarching dynamic of Western history since the rise of the machine age has been a double motion: the attempt to subject society to the mechanisms of the market system, and the corresponding responses by society to defend itself against the damages wrought by this system. This same dynamic is now being played out on a global level. The integration of economic activity within the broader frame of social values is still a feature of societies that are today struggling to protect these values from the corrosive effects of capitalism. Were Western attitudes less blinkered, there would be greater recognition of the urgent need to learn from societies that have retained something that Western culture has lost over the last 200 years. But herein lies the tragedy. It is precisely because Western culture has lost this knowledge that it fails to recognize its value. It is a case of cultural amnesia, and its effects are felt at the deepest levels of modern living. In our time, the issues attending the long domination of market logic in Western society have become subtler, more complex, and more difficult to perceive because the problems are now as much questions of ideology and the patterns of popular consciousness as they are of material welfare. Any attempted solution or alternative to the prevailing form of free market capitalism will have to contend with these non-material realities. The submersion of our social identities entailed in the creation of economic man has prompted the emergence of two contradictory realities in the human experience. The first is the growth of material wealth to a scale beyond imagining in any age previous to our own. It is the undeniable and crowning achievement of capitalism in all its forms. The second has been the spiritual and social impoverishment that lies at the bottom of a profound sense of unhappiness and longing that has become a defining feature of modern industrial civilization. This is the great paradox of our age, the happiness paradox. It would appear that such unhappiness and the illusion of material gratification on which it rests is the psychic price to be borne for the type of wealth we have created. The severance of the individual from society and the pathological inflation of individualism that is its counterpart are at the foundation of free market psychology. These are essential conditions of our material wealth, and at the same time, the source of a profound spiritual malaise that makes us incapable of deriving the happiness we seek from the wealth we consume. It is as if the myth of Tantalus has materialized in the spiritual condition of our culture. Happiness recedes as we stretch our hands to the material wealth we desire. And perhaps it could not be otherwise, for the disjunction between unlimited material acquisition, avarice, and personal happiness is a fundamental truth of moral philosophy and religious teaching leading back to ancient times. But never before has this tension between the material and the spiritual been institutionalized in an economic system that so devalues the social and the spiritual in favor of the material. By spiritual, I mean simply the sensibility to a value or meaning that transcends material pursuits. The poisonous consequences of such an obsessively materialistic worldview, the social and spiritual corrosions that flow from it, are apparent everywhere. They show in the insatiable appetite for consumption that drives us compulsively to satisfy material desire as a solace to sadness, in the demonization of socialism and the mistrust of collective action and the pursuit of shared benefit, in the contempt of government and the idea of the public, in the unraveling of the very social bonds and fellow feeling that are, in times of crisis, the final security against danger, in the perverse sense that our self-worth is bound up in the things we buy, in the utter lack of comprehension in the minds of those who, like Margaret Thatcher, truly believe that society is a fiction and nothing more than a collection of individuals, and, most disturbingly, in the difficulty people have in imagining any alternative to the present system. This inability to imagine an alternative is the final triumph of ideology. As William Leach put it so well, the enthronement of consumerism and the acceptance of corporate capitalism as its social mechanism has diminished public life, denying people everywhere access to insight into other ways of organizing and conceiving life, insight that might have endowed their consent to the dominant culture with real democracy. It is here that the most difficult, the most necessary work must be done to advance a more fully human vision of what economies might be and how such economies might be constructed. Alternatives do exist. The effort to construct economic systems with a more human face has been attempted since the dawn of the industrial age, and the impact of these attempts on capitalism has been decisive in making our own market system more humane. For the task has been not only to construct a more humane alternative to the free market model, but also to humanize the model we do have. The effort to socialize economics through the creation of collective models of production and exchange has been at the center of a reform movement stretching back for 2.5 centuries. All these efforts, embodying the idea of socialism in some form, reflect the attempt to transcend the self-regulating market by consciously subordinating it to the needs of society through democratic means. This book argues that the most enduring and the most promising of these efforts is the use of cooperation as a model for economic and social exchange, and the use of reciprocity as the basis for both economic and social reform. The following chapters will attempt to show why this is true, how the cooperative experience is being played out in both advanced industrial societies and in developing ones, and in what ways the cooperative movement worldwide is succeeding and failing in its mission to construct a humane alternative to free market capitalism.